this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be those of David Gewirtz, and we're going to be talking about his book, Where Have All the Emails Gone? Where have all the emails gone? And he's talking about the White House emails. I think they're close to 500,000 emails. How many emails have disappeared, David?
Well, we know specifically. Hi, Stan. How are you? I love Monterey Bay. We know specifically that the White House has stated that messages from the period of time from March 2003 to May 2003 have gone missing, although we don't have an exact count. Other entities have stated that there are anywhere from 500,000 to a million messages missing, but I honestly think that it's a smaller group than that, but there are quite a few messages that are unaccounted for.
Well, now, how could they possibly lose all those emails? Certainly, they're electronically stored in the memory of the computers there. Or is it just that they do not want any public revelation about what they've really been up to?
Well, the second part of that question is a little bit more of, you know, trying to read the minds of people in Washington, which certainly I'm not particularly good at. But the first part of that question I can answer pretty clearly. Email messages and any kind of computer document are often stored on a computer hard drive, but the management of that process is relatively complex and subject to all sorts of errors. So moving that body of messages from place to place could involve losing information. Moving that body of messages, those hard drives could have been either crashed or destroyed or something like that. But just because they're computer-based doesn't necessarily mean that they're available and archived for us today. And in fact, from what we found in terms of how the White House has managed the information technology operation there, they have not used best practices in terms of the way, the technical way in which they manage their email. And so the potential for loss of correspondence is relatively high. And as we've seen from the testimony by the White House's Chief Information Officer, Teresa Payton, they have in fact lost some number of relatively important message traffic during a very key part of our recent history.
But of course the IRS expects us to keep all of our records, and we can be held liable if we refuse to provide the records for the IRS. How can the federal government have one set of standards for the White House and another for poor people, you know, little people like you and me?
That's a question I ask every single day. It's not only the IRS. There are email tracking requirements for larger and smaller corporations as well. And one of the concerns as an information technology professional that I had is that no corporate or industrial chief information officer would be allowed to get away with the worst practices behavior that appears to have occurred at the White House during the last few years in terms of information technology management. And so it is an interesting question. There is definitely a double standard, but, you know, neither you nor I are the President of the United States, and so we also don't have our own private pastry chef.
Well, but of course, certainly we have a right to be suspicious that maybe they're just concealing the truth. After all, there's never been an administration that has worked in the degree of secrecy that this one classified all sorts of information. You know, it seems to run roughshod over the Freedom of Information Act. It's almost as if they just don't want the American people to know what they're doing. Did you ever have that feeling?
Yes, absolutely. And it's more of a question than necessarily a feeling. I mean, one of the things that I've attempted to do, and given this information, it's been a little bit of a challenge, is I've attempted to try to sort of stay non-political in the sense of not judging them based on personal political beliefs, but more on technical practices.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. We're bringing some other stations on and losing a few. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is David Gewirtz, and he is, of course, an investigative reporter. He's written a book titled, Where Did All the Emails Gone? Where have all the emails gone? And, of course, he's talking about the emails which have there at the White House which have been subpoenaed for various investigations. And, oh, shucks, well, they suggested that as many as 500,000 emails have just sort of disappeared. Now, sending my emails are all on my hard drive. Of course, I don't have 500,000 of them, but I got an awful lot of them there, and I'm sure some could get on my hard drive and recover an awful lot of those. And, of course, there have been a number of investigations going on, whether it be Valerie Plume. I mean, who was it who leaked the information that she was a CIA operative? Never to punish her or punish her husband because of remarks she had made that were critical of the Bush administration. And there have been other investigations and similar investigations, and everything seems to be cover-up, cover-up, cover-up. So you pick up the story there, David. Why did you write the book? Where did all the emails go, and what was your conclusion?
Well, let me give you a moment or two of background. My day job is as the editor-in-chief of a publishing company called Zatz Publishing. We publish technical publications online, ranging from consumer electronics up through enterprise information technology for IBM-related products. And two of those publications, Outlook Power Magazine, which is at outlookpower.com, and Domino Power Magazine, which is at dominopower.com, cover email and collaboration software for industries and for end users who are using email. About a year ago, in April of 2007, we started to see some minor news reports about the potential of the White House having misplaced this batch of emails, about 500,000 emails. And we decided to pick it up as a story since it was email-related, and that's a big part of what we cover in the magazines. We thought we'd pick up the story and run with it. And we thought it was going to be, I honestly thought it was going to be a relatively short story, just a little piece of coverage, until I started to look at what was being stated in the White House press conferences to reporters about the email messages and about what they were saying about the various email messages. And as somebody who works with the technologies that they used, basically Domino Power Magazine is about IBM Lotus Notes and Domino, which is the technology that used to be used at the White House for managing email. And Outlook Power Magazine deals with Outlook and Exchange, which is the technology that is currently used at the White House for managing email. So we're really deep into the tech. And what happened was, as they were doing these press conferences, and I started looking at the transcripts of the press conferences...
I'm going to have to ask you to hold there for just a moment. We're going to bring the other stations back on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is David Gewirtz, and of course, he worked for a company that actually publishes trade journals having to do with electronics, things of that sort. And of course, a lot of the work that they do has to do with emails. And so when he saw the story that the White House seemed to have accidentally misplaced, I want you to understand, they said they are people of honesty and integrity, and they've just accidentally misplaced 500,000 emails. They just can't find them at all. Why, David got onto this story and began evaluating it. And, of course, I don't know whether he's coming from a conservative or a liberal point of view. It really doesn't matter. The major question is, do we have a government that is, of course, subservient to the people, or do we have a government that is controlling the people and is operating in secrecy, not to conceal the truth from Osama bin Laden hiding over there in the cave in Pakistan, but to conceal the truth about what the real thrust and real agenda of the American government is? And I'd like to suggest it's the latter. I believe our government is intent upon fighting war after war after war, and it doesn't matter what the people want. There is a small clique who control our government, who are following the rules set out by Machiavelli and the Prince, and they're being carried out very effectively today. But let's hear what David Gewirtz has to say about where the emails have gone and why they can't be found. So you pick up the story there, David.
Okay. So what I noticed, as I was mentioning, is that, and this is a much bigger story than I think you think it is, because this is not just about missing emails. What I discovered was that there were some very serious national security holes that put our government at risk because of the way that email is managed at the White House. Something else I discovered was that email management at the White House hasn't just been a problem with the Bush administration, what has been a problem with every administration going back to when email began at the White House, which was back at the beginning of the Reagan era. So there were email problems and email archiving problems and email reporting problems that went back through Ronald Reagan's administration, through the first President Bush's administration, through President Clinton's administration, and now through the second President Bush's administration. So this is a systemic issue and a systemic problem that encompasses an awful lot. Now, buried underneath the systemic problem comes the question of, are we looking at incompetence or are we looking at something heinous? And that one, I and many other IT professionals who I've talked to have a hard time figuring out which is which. But we can say, for example, that the missing email messages that have been confirmed by the White House between March and May of 2003, those messages occurred during the time of the whole Valerie Plame issue. They occurred during the buildup of weapons of mass destruction. They occurred during the time period just before and beginning the war in Iraq. So those are presidential records that we'd all like to be able to have preserved according to the Presidential Records Act in a way so that we as American people, in a way as historians 12 years or so hence when they become available, and for future administrations, we'd all like to know what went on during that time frame. And unfortunately, at the moment, it looks like that particular very important piece of recent history has been lost. Now, is that bad behavior, or is that bad practice, or is there something more devious at work? That one, you know, is up to your personal beliefs. Personally, I can't answer that one, although I would really prefer to not have to answer that one.
Well, we won't ask you why these things are going. I would point out that we know that General Petraeus, when he was over there training the Iraqi army, just accidentally misplaced 200,000 weapons, automatic rifles, pistols, things of that sort. 200,000 of them. How could you do that? And then we find out that they lost $8 billion and we sent it over there. They don't know what happened to it. Recently, of course, I was reading something about the Pentagon, that almost half of the $360 billion budget, they don't know what happens to the money. It just sort of disappears, goes here, there, goes elsewhere. But they need more money for next year because, boy, they got a lot of great projects coming down the line. How could you run anything as inefficiently as government does? I mean, if you were in private industry, you'd be fired tomorrow.
I got to tell you, if I misplaced $8 billion of cash, somebody would not be happy with me. I mean, that one astonishes me. And again, regardless of political affiliation, $8 billion in cash could have been put to such better use than distributed to some unknown group of people because they lost it. That's not my subject area, so I probably shouldn't rant on that too much.
I just use that as an analogy, but you go right ahead, David, because people would much rather hear you than hear me. Go right ahead.
I'm not too sure about that, but I'll take that for at least a good start. So anyway, here's the issue. Okay, you've got actually a couple things going on. You've got the concern about missing email messages, but we also have a concern about something called the Hatch Act. Now, the Hatch Act was put into practice in 1939. A little earlier than email existed by, 40 years or so, 30 years, something like that. So you've got a law that is on the books that was written before the technology that we're using today exists that governs how the White House uses email today, which, if you might imagine, is kind of complex. What the Hatch Act does is it says that the White House cannot use public resources, government resources, for political purposes. So in other words, if someone is sending an email message that has to do with a campaign schedule or something like that, they can't use the government email system to do that. Instead, they must use a private email system. And this got me thinking, because the private email system they use is located in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and every email message that a White House staffer sends of a political nature cannot travel over the protected government systems. Instead, it travels over the open internet, 1,200 miles down to Chattanooga from Washington, D.C., and then 1,200 miles back from Chattanooga back to Washington, D.C., completely unprotected. And that was the first and biggest national security risk concern that I found in this investigation. Another question that came to mind was, part of the reason that the White House is claiming they lost these email messages is because they switched from Lotus Notes to Microsoft Outlook. And initially they were claiming that Lotus Notes was a relatively obsolete system, which is, it's anything but. Lotus Notes is an enterprise-grade IBM primary product that many, many corporations throughout the world rely on, specifically because of how reliable it is in its ability to maintain its databases and how secure it is in its ability to send messages back and forth. So the White House replaced Lotus Notes with Microsoft Outlook, which when Outlook and Exchange are configured are also enterprise class. They're both great systems. But the question that I asked was, why during the buildup of a war, why during the midst of this enormous crisis point, would you take out a key command and control system from the White House and replace it with something else? I mean, if you had to change your email system and update your computers, it would be a pain in the neck. Imagine taking that core system out from 3,000 workers at the White House and replacing it with something else and also worrying about how you transfer all your historical message traffic and everything else over. They did that transition during the build-up to war, and then that's one of the reasons they say they can't find these missing messages, because they transitioned from one incredibly capable enterprise-class email messaging system to another reasonably capable enterprise-class messaging system.
Well, of course, if you were a suspicious sort of individual, which I know you're not, but I am,
not.
And I would think that, you know, maybe if I was doing something that was a little underhanded, that may result in a million or so deaths, the last thing I would want would be a paper trail there that would let people know. For instance, for years, off a Tonkin incident, they had to convince the American people it was real. It wasn't. Only recently has it come out that it was all fraudulent. 3 million Vietnamese died, 58,000 American boys died for nothing. And now, of course, we have the next war coming down. You certainly wouldn't want a paper trail that would, of course, lead to that. But then maybe I'm just being paranoid. Maybe there was just total incompetence that they would go from a very efficient system to a less efficient system simply as the war was developing.
Well, there you go. And so now you're looking at issue one of moving from one efficient system to one slightly less efficient system. You're looking at item two, which is a whole pile of missing email messages. You're looking at item three, which is email messages being sent through an insecure system. And one of the things that we're also looking at, which the people who are suing the White House for recovery of the messages refuse to look at, is we're also looking at an entire message base that's outside the control of the White House systems. So imagine this for a moment. You have a White House system, a computer network that exists inside the executive office of the president. That system is the one that's for government-related communication, where everything that relates to the communication is of a completely non-political nature. Not a whole lot of that happens in any presidential government, because obviously there's always a political component to it. Now you've got a completely separate network. That's the network that you use for your political communication. That's the one that occurs out of Chattanooga, Tennessee. Now, what's happening is the government investigators, then the people who are suing the White House for disclosure of these messages, are only looking at the White House system. So they're only looking at the system that lives inside the executive office of the president. And my estimation was that more than 103.6 million messages occurred related to the White House outside of the government system through the system coming out of Chattanooga, Tennessee. So as a result, we have an entire library, not just 5 million messages, but there's 103.6 million messages that are not only not accounted for, but are also not even being looked at, that are probably subject to the Presidential Records Act, and all of which were sent in securely.
All right. Now, why are these lawsuits being brought? Who's bringing these lawsuits? Is it Judicial Watch, or who's bringing the lawsuits?
There are two watchdog groups, one called CRU, which is Citizens Responsible Ethical Washington or something like that. I'm sorry, I don't know their full name, but they're a watchdog group that is looking at trying to recover these messages for the Presidential Records Act. And the other is the National Security Archive of George Washington University, which has approached the email preservation problem for each president since President Reagan. They've fought to preserve presidential records both with President Reagan and with President Bush, as well as President Clinton, and now this President Bush. And so these two entities are bringing these lawsuits to preserve these records. Now, the downside is, of course, these two entities also need some good public relations, and so their public relations says it's much more interesting to sue the White House than it is to sue for records to sue a small Chattanooga company. But the fact is a lot of that stuff occurred through Chattanooga as opposed to through Washington.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment with our special guest talking about his book, Where Have All the Emails Gone? Where have all the emails gone? Well, David, pick the story up from there.
Okay. So we've now looked at three or four components of the problem. Since that time, we've had a number of congressional testimony occurrences, basically the House oversight. We've got a couple of entities doing this. Not only do we have CRU and the National Security Archive, we also have the House Oversight Committee, which is the committee designed to focus on oversight and government reform, who brought the Chief Information Officer of the White House over to testify on the behavior of the security of these messages. We have the National Archives, which is where the messages are supposed to wind up after the president, you know, after the administration is done. It's where all presidential records are supposed to get dumped onto. And then you also have the district court judge who is adjudicating this thing. So we've got a lot of bodies playing around here, all sort of jockeying for this information. So we've talked about the judge and we talked about the lawsuits, but there's been testimony in front of the House Oversight Committee, which gives us a really good record to explore what they're actually saying. And key people who testified in that are, in particular, the Chief Information Officer at the White House, who's only been there for the last couple of years. So she has no information. In fact, nobody in the chain of command that we've seen actually worked at the White House during the time of this transition or during the time that these messages are being looked for. So we have this other interesting thing of we're asking people who, if they know about it at all, only know about it through hearsay as opposed to through their actual experience. But from their testimony, we found out a couple of other interesting things. Like, for example, Theresa Payton, the Chief Information Officer there, has told us that they have no mechanism for securing physical computer assets at the White House. They don't track them at all. So if you've used a computer, you know that there's not only your computer and your hard drive, but very often there's a little add-on hard drive that's off to the side that you might do backups on. There's these little thumb drives that you take from computer to computer to you know, carry your information back and forth. There's these mobile devices like BlackBerries or smartphones or whatever. And according to the White House, they have no tracking mechanism at all for keeping track of all these little tiny nightmares waiting to happen that people can walk around with. So the first question, of course, is that we now have not only a security problem with messages being sent, we have a security problem with all of these little tiny assets that can carry a tremendous amount of information. Let me give you an example that happened based on both testimony and what happened a couple weeks ago. Last year, Susan Ralston, who was the assistant to Karl Rove was the deputy chief of staff at the White House, she testified that on numerous occasions Mr. Rove lost his BlackBerry, which is a little smartphone that contains some information, and he used it constantly to discuss White House operations. She mentioned that he had lost it a number of times. Now, the House Oversight Committee didn't really focus on that. They just let that testimony go, but I found it while digging through the discussion. I marked that off as a security risk in the book, but about 4 weeks ago, the President of the United States, the President of Canada, and the Prime Minister of Mexico were meeting in New Orleans. The President of our country and the Prime Minister of Mexico went into a conference room with their staffers. Their staffers were asked to not bring their smartphones into the meeting for security purposes, and they put their BlackBerries in a bin outside the conference room, at which point a Mexican national picked up the BlackBerries and left the hotel with them and went off to the airport. Now, those BlackBerries can hold at minimum the equivalent of 7 full copies of the 7 Harry Potter novels, which, as you might imagine, is a whole lot of books, or the equivalent of 64 copies of the King James Bible. So you're talking about a tremendous
amount of... Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, one of the things that they're very, very concerned about, David's very concerned about, is the accessibility of information, of private information. And certainly he's commenting that Karl Rove lost his BlackBerry, which he uses and has all of this sensitive information on it a number of times. And then, of course, David was telling about a recent meeting between the President of the United States, the Premier of Canada, the President of Mexico. And, of course, they went into a very private meeting. The staff was told that they could not bring in their cell phones because, of course, if you know they can monitor a cell phone, you think your cell phone's turned off? If they can't listen to you? Of course they can. Same thing with the BlackBerries. They took all those things. They put them in a big bin outside the room. Then they went in so they would really have secrecy and nobody could overhear what they were saying. and some Mexican fella comes along, picks up the bin, and goes off to the airport. What was he doing? I mean, was he a spy, or was he just not very competent?
Well, let's be clear that this wasn't just some Mexican fellow. This was the person who was listed, according to the delegation, as the press advance person for the Mexican delegation. So he was a Mexican government official.
All right.
And that becomes important when you look at the question of was this an intelligence operation or not. A lot of us, I mean, especially if you've been looking at the news, a lot of people have a perspective of Mexico that may or may not be particularly promising. But this is the 12th largest economy in the world. And they certainly have a very strong police force and a very strong national intelligence agency. Now, while they are our allies, there are also certain issues that we disagree with. And so you have an interesting question. If you can acquire communications devices that contain a large amount of information from a country you were negotiating for, and you can take that information away and potentially use it to your advantage, could this have been an intelligence operation? And everything that I see points to it as most probably some form of intelligence operation, or at least a target of opportunity, where the information on those BlackBerries may have been modified, or there's something else that's going on, which is that there is a way in about 5 minutes to modify a BlackBerry and certain other smartphones so that although you as a carrier will never know it, those phones can be dialed up and then you can listen to anything in the room where the smartphone is without the person who owns the phone even knowing it. These are basically called exploits, and you can actually exploit the phone. So on one hand, they may have been extracting information off the smartphones, and on the other, they may have been putting an exploit onto the phone that makes them far less secure. So we're looking, again, what we're seeing here is we're not only seeing questions about security and questions about how these things are used and questions about politics, we're seeing a real mix of all these issues that relate to very, very poor management about a technology that most of us don't take all that seriously but could cause us enormous harm.
You might think that somebody in the president's entourage would have thought maybe we ought to put a guard on all of these electronic devices that contain so much information. You would think that they might have done that, but apparently they're really not concerned.
Well, when they came out and they were missing, they did talk to the Secret Service, but these devices were in the hands of the Mexican government for at least 20 minutes, and as far as I can tell, probably considerably longer. And it is absolutely possible to both remove information and do an exploit like that in less than 20 minutes. So, again, you've got this risk. And so what we're finding here is, as I've continued to explore this area of electronic communications at the White House, and I need to be clear that I've explored it only from the public-facing point of view. In other words, I've not done anything other than with publicly available information, public testimony, information from press briefings, that sort of thing. This is just what they tell us, not necessarily what else is going on behind the scenes. As I've explored that information, I've continued to get more and more concerned. And one of the things that I did in the book was make a set of recommendations that are very easy to implement to fix this so this doesn't happen in future administrations. Now, whether they'll ever do that or not, again, is an interesting problem. But we're seeing not just this archiving problem and not just a transmission security problem, but we're also seeing a problem with all these little gadgets going around, these little teeny, mini nightmares that can get lost or stolen.
Well, I think that we should really be very, very concerned if we really believe that there are threats out there to the integrity of our government, and certainly our intelligence is important, and we're certainly spending, I don't know how many billion dollars on intelligence and secret operations. Why, you would think that they would do everything they could to guard that information, and yet, of course, everything suggests that we just have no idea how to be secure. We just don't know much about what anything's going on in the world. Our intelligence is all wrong. We had no idea there was going to be an attack on the Twin Towers. We had no idea, of course, anybody would ever think of using an airplane to fly it into one of our buildings. And yet, of course, what they've never told the American people is on that very morning of September 11th, there were at least a number, of course, military exercises, and at least one of them involved hijacking a plane and flying it into an American building. I believe it was the Pentagon. But, of course, the rest of the intelligence agency had no idea what the military was doing. They've been planning for just this event for so long, but nobody ever talks to anybody. That's why we have so much trouble. Or is that really true?
Well, you know,
this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is David Goritz. And go ahead, David.
Well, what I was about to say as the music came through, that's an area that again, I'm not particularly an expert in. But, you know, we have a situation in both industry as well as in government where it's very difficult for people to work together and collaborate. And there are we've built technology tools. In fact, Notes and Domino and Exchange and all these buzzwords are tools that are designed to help us collaborate. But they're a double-edged sword, because as we build tools that allow us to collaborate, the communication itself is potentially subject to risk. So if I can easily tell, for example, whether my coworker is at his or her desk through something called presence awareness, then we can actually, then that information is transmitting over an open internet that somebody else can potentially find that out as well. So we have one of these very interesting, it gives stuff to us but it's away from us kinds of situations. And certainly in a bureaucracy the size of the United States government, you're going to have a situation where all these different entities aren't able to talk together as efficiently as they want, both for political reasons and through practical reasons. And part of why it's so important that we get email secured and locked down for the government to use is because that kind of communication is essential, and we don't want to have to sit there worrying whether or not, once they're finally talking to each other, whether that stuff is going to be intercepted by a foreign power or some other enemy of the state. And, you know, so we need to make sure that these systems are secured. We need to make sure, we need to modify the Hatch Act in particular, because the Hatch Act has to allow our government to use government resources for security purposes, even if it costs the U.S. government a little bit to do so. Because we just can't have that stuff going through the open internet all the time, which is incredibly open for anybody to get. I don't know if you know too much about the internet's history, but the internet was never designed for the kind of load that it has now. It was also never designed for security issues. It was an academic system, and before that it was designed as a system for our own military defense, but it was never designed for large quantities of worldwide consumers to be able to gain access to it. And so when you send an email message, that message is inherently insecure. It uses something called the Simple Mail Transport Protocol, and the operative word here is simple, where it basically takes your message in plain text and puts a little bit of stuff around the outside of it and pumps it across the internet through a whole pile of different nodes till it gets to the other end and the other person gets it. But that message is completely open and completely readable during the entire process. So if you're sitting at a, let's say, a Starbucks, or you're sitting at a Borders, or you're sitting someplace else at a hotel, and you're typing your message away.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a minute at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and before we go on with what David was saying, why I want him to get out his website, I want him to tell our listeners how they can get copies of his book. So would you like to take this opportunity to have a little plug for your material?
We love shameless plugs.
Right, go ahead.
So let's start off with a little giving back to your readers as well as pointing out where they can get the book. We have a website called www.emailsgone, that's emailsgone.com, which is the home website for the book. Now, on there, in addition to the big button you can push on the front, which will take you to Amazon for ordering the book, there's also a button that says how to get help. And this is for information on how to secure your own personal email system, your own private home-based internet, all sorts of issues. We have a whole section on, for example, internet safety for grandparents. All of that is on the How to Get Help page. Also, there's been a lot of breaking news updates about this story as it progresses. So there's an updates button. You push the updates button, and all of those stories and the breaking news and information on it are available to your listeners for free. They can just read through that. Likewise, there's another section on resources, and all of that are copies of every single forensic resource that was used for creating the information that's in the book. So if people want to look at that information, if they want to confirm what I've seen, if they want to do their own analysis, all of that stuff is online on that site as well, and that, too, is also free.
All right, well, now, of course, during the break, why David was saying that what most people don't understand is that email was never created for what it is today. And originally, it had to do with the military, and then, of course, it gradually progressed to where it is today, where everybody can access it, but it was never meant to do that. And when you send out an email message from you to somebody else, it goes through all sorts of intermediaries, and anybody who really has the technology can read your email. Would that be a fair statement?
That is correct.
And of course,
absolutely correct.
This should certainly be a major concern, you know, if we believe in government secrecy. And let's imagine that what we've been told is really true. America, of course, is the greatest nation in the world, but everybody out there really doesn't like us. A lot of them would like to destroy this nation. As the president says, you know, the terrorists are out there. They want to destroy it, so they would have access to all these emails as well. Certainly, there are very, very smart Arabs out there. You would think that that if this is a real problem, the government would have a separate form of email, or a secure type of email, or some sort of a coded email using the various techniques that are for encryption that are available, so that you know, you could encrypt it at one end and unencrypt it at the other. But government information would not be readily available to our enemies if indeed what we're told is true, and they really do have enemies out there who want to get us. So pick up the story.
Well, let's be clear that we absolutely do have enemies out there that want to get us.
All right.
It's not necessarily the same enemies we're always talking about. I mean, we're not. I can't tell you, and frankly, my personal issues notwithstanding, but there are people who want to gain access, for example, to our financial strength and wealth. So you have a lot of very, very impoverished Eastern European countries who, through the use of a small computer, can attempt to do identity theft on American citizens and gain access to their bank accounts or their credit cards or purchase things using them and so forth. That is a risk as well. You know, and then there are, of course, other nations who may or may not want to do us harm but would certainly like to have a negotiating advantage when it comes to, you know, how we interact. We have a number of cases throughout history where allies have spied on each other, not necessarily to cause damage to the other party, but to gain a competitive advantage, if you will, in their relationships with the other party. So, for example, if you know something, if you and I are negotiating to do a deal, for example, and you know that I need to do the deal no matter what, and I think you think that I just kind of want to do the deal, you'll push that advantage as hard as you can. But if you know that I can just walk away, you might not push it as hard. And that piece of competitive information can transform a lot. Now, we're negotiating with Mexico, for example, over all sorts of things, and if they know a little bit more about where we're willing to cave and where we're willing to stand firm, that gives them a competitive advantage. And that might be the same case with other allies. Likewise, of course, if our enemies know things, if people who want to do damage to, you know, the interests of America as a whole know information, well, that's a different story. I mean, the folks who flew those airplanes into the World Trade Center did not have our best interest at heart. And, you know, if they know a little bit more than we want them to know, then that gives them an advantage we do not want to let them have.
I agree with you totally. So anyway, you have to ask yourself why we're not doing what would be logical. I mean, I'm not a computer technologist at all, but I was thinking it would be a very, very easy thing to encrypt your messages on one end and decipher them on the other. Certainly the technology is there. Our intelligence agencies know how to do it. They're just not doing it. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, you can actually, and in fact, one of the things you should do if you can is you can consider, for example, encrypting. If you sent me a message, for example, and you're 24 hops away on RadioLiberty.com from my computer here, if you wanted to send me a message that traveled over those 24 hops, you would be able to encrypt it using even something as free as PGP, which is pretty good privacy. Encrypt that message and send it to me, and I would decrypt it. But it takes a specific conscious action to make that happen. And a lot of people who are very busy, who are going from meeting to meeting, who are working, you know, 18-hour days, don't bother to do it. Likewise, if that message is retrieved by the kid down the street, it might be a little hard for him to crack it. But if that message is retrieved at, say, Hop 15 by a nation state, and that nation state wanted to see what was going on in that message, they could break the encryption, although it would take quite a bit of work. They could do so. And so they might sit there monitoring traffic, like we did in World War II, monitoring as much traffic as possible, running it through, and seeing what kind of take came from that intelligence. So even though it is encrypted and travels over the open Internet, or even though if it were encrypted and traveled over the open Internet, it's still possible for it to be to our disadvantage. And that's why, I mean, frankly, the Hatch Act has to be modified so that we can use America's, you know, very, very strong government systems to protect important government communication. And then you and I, as consumers and as citizens, we need to be aware that when we send a message or when we use the Internet, we need to take a lot of precautions as well. A very important lesson to your listeners is never, ever, 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 ever send a credit card number through email, period, ever, because it can be intercepted. You also want to make sure that you have your antivirus software up and running and make sure that you run those updates. Make sure you update your version of Windows or your Macintosh OS or Linux, although the Linux guys always know what they're doing, to make sure that it's up to date so all the defenses are in place. Never open an email attachment, even if it's from somebody you know, because that email attachment could carry a payload that could suck everything on your computer out and send it to somebody else, or could turn your computer into a weapon that attacks other computers. This stuff is all real. It sounds science fiction-y, and it sounds arcane, but it's happening to grandparents and moms and dads and radio hosts and computer experts all across the country. And we have to take precautions, and we have to all learn to be aware of what goes on inside our computers, because if we don't, that lack of knowledge could really hurt us.
All right, fine. Well, Chris, so many of my friends will send me attachments, you know, to my emails. They'll send me a letter or an article or a report, something like that. And you're suggesting that we should, even if we know who's sending it, we should never pull it down?
I'm not suggesting it. I'm demanding it, actually.
All right.
Because what happens is, for example, people know my email address. I'm a very public person, so people know my email address. And so, and you're a very public person, so people know your email address. And they can send a message that looks like it's coming from you. They can, you know, spoof, which is basically tweak the email message, and send it to people you know or send it to people you don't know so it looks like it's coming from you. And even though it looks like it's coming from you, and it might even have something specifically related to something that might be coming from you, they can embed onto that an attachment that is not. Worse, what's even more problematic is the person on the other end could have been sending you a legitimate attachment, a legitimate piece of information that they want you to look at, but their computer is already compromised. And if their computer is already compromised, even though it's an attachment that they're sending you in good faith, that attachment may also be compromised, thereby compromising your computer and propagating the mess on out. Creepy, huh?
It sure is. It's a little scary.
I work with this stuff professionally, and it freaks me out. And you know, the more I look at it, the more I talk to you know, law enforcement who's looking at this and so forth, the more it becomes really clear that this is a real interesting problem. And I mean, completely separate from the issue of the White House's security, our own personal security is very important. You know, your homeland security begins at home. And so we have to make sure that we understand how to set up our routers. We have to make sure we know how to protect our wireless internet. If you're using a laptop and you haven't set up your wireless encryption over your laptop, you need to make sure you do so. The fact is that, like you would put a fence around your pool so a kid doesn't fall into the pool, you need to put a fence around your home's internet to make sure that people from the outside don't get into your home's internet and vice versa.
What about something like PayPal, which, of course, for many of the various corporations use, in order for people to make donations to a charity, something like that? Is PayPal safe?
Yes and no. If you go to the PayPal website and you type in www.paypal.com and you go to their website and you make sure that on the bottom of your browser that little padlock icon is visible, you're about 95% safe. But if PayPal sends you an email that says, please check your account or your account is overdue or you're going to get a donation, or even if it looks like it's from PayPal, even if everything indicates it's from PayPal, the odds are it's not from PayPal, and that is absolutely unsafe.
I know, of course, we get these things from eBay all the time, and certainly, you know, of course, your eBay account, you know, of course, we don't have an eBay account. We don't even go there, but we know that there are all these scams out there. And for people who do not know, you never, 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 never give out any personal information when somebody asks for it. We want to check your account. We're from Citibank, you know, we're checking your credit card account, and of course, Citibank doesn't do that. They call you, but they certainly don't send you an email.
Well, let's also talk about calling you while we're being paranoid here for a second.
Sure, go ahead.
If they call you up and they ask you for your credit card information, don't give it to them because it may not be them.
Right.
Make sure that if let's say Citibank calls you up and says that your credit card is about to be, you know, nuked or you're going to go to jail or some other horrible thing. Get some details from them, but don't use the phone number they give you, because if you call back, you might also not be talking to a Citibank person. Go and go find your billing statement, find the contact number on the billing statement, and call the bank from that billing statement. Now, this has been happening in particular recently to senior executives at senior corporations who are getting very, very personalized messages telling them that they are going to be brought before a U.S. tax court. And the personalized messages know an awful lot about their business and about them. And it's telling them to click on links to go visit this tax court thing to make sure that they're not, you know, going to be late in their payments and whatever. This is a spoof, but many senior executives in the United States are finding themselves very much compromised because this thing looked really real. It's not. None of this stuff is real. Be distrustful of email. It's important to do that. It's a very valuable resource, but again, we got to watch over it. And that's the message from the White House as well. It's an incredibly valuable resource, email communication within the highest office of the land, but it's also something that is very possible to compromise. And that's why we need to put in real systems, real new systemic systems, not just for political reasons, so we can beat presidents over the head for being, you know, bad presidents, but also so we can make sure that, you know, other mistakes that they weren't intending to make also happen or don't happen as well. So we want to make sure that this stuff changes. I've recommended that we set up something called an electronic communications protection detail that's part of the Secret Service that oversees everything the White House does with electronic communications and spans administration so to make sure that, these little changes in email systems don't happen in the middle of things like builds up to war and so forth. I've also recommended we change the Hatch Act. And if we make those two changes alone, White House email security will increase tremendously, and we might not have little problems like what happened in the build-up to a war with all those missing email messages. And we wouldn't have questions like what were they doing and what are they potentially hiding. We'd actually have those records. They'd be available, and then it would become a policy decision whether they were released or not.
All right, fine. Krishna, what the government always does, you know, we can't put this out in the name of the National Security, the State Secret Act, or something of that sort, if they don't want the public to know, or if they've done something dishonest and a million people died, the last thing they'd ever want would be the American people to know the truth. Well, Sydney, what sort of response are you getting, David? Your book must be out circulating across the country. We've been contacted on it, and Sydney, you've got a good public relations group out there circulating information. So what are your suggestions being considered, you know?
They're sort of being considered. I mean, I've been in touch with everything from the FBI to the National to the Office of Special Counsel to the House Oversight Committee and a variety of other government entities, as well as a large number of information technology professionals and tons of radio programs and newspapers and so forth. And we're dealing with a little bit of a political issue, trying to get the concept of it's not just the White House, it's also how messages are being sent through this third-party entity and the Hatch Act. But it's starting to get heard. I mean, what's kind of cool, I mean, you're basically, for all intents and purposes, I'm an individual in a small company, and I'm starting to get heard. I mean, these things are starting to get being written up in major publications. We've been picked up on the AP. We've been picked up in the Washington Post. We've been picked up by you. We've been written up in major technology publications. So the dialogue is beginning. Now, will Washington ever listen to that, or is it more important to interview a guy about, you know, a baseball player about steroids? You're always dealing with Washington in that context, but at least the conversation is getting started and more people are listening, and hopefully at some point we'll start to see some movement on issues like changing the Hatch Act and making the Secret Service responsible for you know, executive office electronic communications and so forth. And I've been very gratified because an awful lot of people have been listening to this message. The book actually hit best-selling status on Amazon for a short time for executive branch books, which I thought was very cool. You know, if your readers go to emailsgone.com and buy it, then it'll do that again. That was a cheap plug, by the way.
That's your right.
I couldn't resist. You know, then this thing will continue to get heard. But it's interesting because it's a very complex, kind of arcane issue that's really important. And it's not nearly as sexy as like an entire war. But what it does is it looks at how things like an entire war were communicated about, and what's the wiring underneath that made that communication happen, and where did those messages go, and could they have been intercepted? Could messages going on now about strategic decisions be intercepted? Those are sorts of things that really need to be listened to, and I do a couple of interviews a week on this topic, and more people are hearing about it, and more people are talking to more people about it. So, you know, hopefully after a while this thing will start to get a life of its own, and we'll see some changes.
Well, I think it's the important thing, one thing to learn is the fact that, you know, in private industry, somebody's responsible. Somebody, you know, that's their job to make sure things run and run efficiently. And certainly in government agencies and government bureaucracies, pretty nobody's responsible, and if anybody is responsible, they always say it wasn't my fault at all. And of course, usually what happens is they get a raise and get promoted, and of course, the old idea is that incompetence rises to the top. You cannot do that in private industry. You wouldn't last at all. And so this is why command or centralized organizations, as you have with the communist states or fascist states, or They do not work efficiently. So, I mean, what you're simply suggesting is somebody be made responsible for government emails. You would think that somebody would have thought of that for a long time ago, but I guess they never thought of it because, well, why bother to do it? In fact, in government, the old idea is don't do anything. If you do something, you know why, that you might be criticized.
Well, I mean, there's some very, very competent government employees as well, but they're not necessarily in the leadership structure.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with David Gerwitz to wrap up today's program. Well, David, you got 3 minutes to wrap up what your thoughts here for our listeners today.
Okay, well, let's start with some of the important go-to items. In addition to things like not sending credit card numbers and so forth, be aware of your technology. And here's another shameless plug. If you go to OutlookPower.com, that's our free weekly magazine on email systems and how to use Outlook and so forth. It has a ton of resources for people who are concerned about making sure their email management is protected. Go visit it. It's free. The same thing is true with emailsgone.com. It also has a ton of resources for making sure you're protected. Whether or not you buy the book or not, make sure that you protect your systems. And then, of course, go buy the book. Go to Amazon and look for Where Have All the Emails Gone, or go to emailsgone.com and do the same thing. And let's be aware of a couple things. I mean, one thing that you said was that government employees are not necessarily competent. There are some who are incredibly competent. I've met some in government and federal law enforcement and Homeland Security who are really on the ball. But we do have leadership problems, and we do have politics problems, and politics is getting in the way of good technology, and we can't let that happen. We need our technology to be secure so then we can go off and be political animals. And keep this discussion up. Go talk to your Congress critters about changing the Hatch Act. Go make sure that talk to them about security of White House email, and make sure your own email is secure. If you work for a company, ask about that. You know, don't rely on the kid down the street to secure your network or your internet. Make sure you learn about it yourself, because you need to know it. That kid down the street that helps secure your internet may decide to use your credit card to go order himself a couple PlayStations.
Well, it's in a whole different world. I was raised in an entirely different world. It was a long, hard job to get to learn to use a computer, and my son is so far superior to it. Fortunately, we have him here to keep us abreast of what's going on, at least to the point where I can keep up with what's happening. What about the encrypting messages? Would this be an important thing to do, and if we were going to do it, how would we do it?
Well, the easiest thing to do is go to Google and look up PGP for pretty good privacy. PGP is a great encryption system. There are add-ons for Firefox and for Outlook and for all the other email clients. And it's a very good encryption tool to use. And if you want to, go ahead and use it. But the problem is the guy on the other end also has to use it. So if you and the person on the other end agree to send these messages back and forth and you feel like encrypting, go ahead and do so. But be aware that, you know, a lot of commercial email is not going to be encrypted. And so there, instead of encrypting the message, make sure you don't stick anything in the message that might be a problem. Make sure you shred your bills before you stick them out in the trash so people can't go dumpster diving and looking for your contact information. You know, be smart about how you let your personal information out there, not only in the internet world, but in the real world as well.
All right, fine. We're out of time, David. Thank you so much. It's been a great program. Pretty appreciate it.
Thank you as well. And everybody have a great time, and I enjoy Monterey.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and David was just saying how much he enjoys Monterey. I think he lives on the East Coast, but certainly we here in living on the North Shore of Monterey Bay, we feel blessed to be here. Well, of course, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners out across America that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and of course, if you listen to our programs, you agree with our message. We hope you'll help us. As in the, we have over 60 outlets now. Every single week we got an additional 7 stations where we do a weekend program, and so our weekend programs goes to 35 stations and people all across America. For a short period of time, once a week for 30 minutes, we'll have an opportunity to hear the truth, and I figure that that's really up to God whether people listen or not. All I can do is put the information out, and if He wants them to listen, they're going to listen. So what we are is simply tools to be used in this great battle that's going on, this spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Now, we do hope that many of you are making preparations for what I believe are very difficult times that lie ahead, and if you have not yet laid in a supply of dehydrated food, of course, if you'd like a catalog, we'd be glad to send you one. But believe me, there are food riots all over the world. There are going to be very real food shortages. The price of food is going up, and I think it's going to go up much higher. But I think down the line we're going to see real food shortages, and they're going to say, "Oh, shucks, we had no idea what was happening. That's why we got rid of all of our supplies. We never thought we'd need them. Oh, shucks, we made another mistake." And ladies and gentlemen, I don't think they're making mistakes. I think they're planning on using new diseases and massive world epidemics. I think they're planning on using war. I think they're using on famine, because there really are people out there who believe there are too many people in the world, and they really want to get rid of most of them. And if you doubt that, you go to Elberton, Georgia, and look at the Georgia Guidestones, as I have, and stand in the shadow of this occult monument, and nobody even knows who put the money up to build it. Most incredible story. But that's for another day. If you haven't heard my talk on Nandair College genocide, if you haven't read my treatise on the Population Control Agenda monograph, if you haven't read or listened to our talk on planned population reduction, you really need to. And then I hope you'll begin to make preparations for yourself and your family. If you'd like a catalog on something on dehydrated food from Ready Reserve, give us a call. As you get it to us, it of course helps Radio Liberty, and we work very closely with Ready Reserve. And I will tell you that we know David Sibley. He is very, very concerned. He's having increasing difficulty getting many of the types of food that they put into their kits and their ready prepared packs. And you're going to see real shortages of food here in America, as incredible as it may seem. But then, when do you ever think that you'd ever see a gasoline at over $4 a gallon? And let me tell you, you'll look back on that as the good old days, because there is a plan to get you out of your car, to lower your living standards, and I believe the price of gasoline is going to go up, as the price of food is going to go up, as the price of electricity and natural gas are going to go up, because of course they really want to impoverish the American people. That's part of the plan. And if you doubt that, you need to read the Earth Charter. You need to read the Global Biodiversity Assessment, which certainly we can give you information on that here at Radio Liberty. We hope that you'll read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or watch the DVD, and tell other people about what's really going on in the world. We hope you get our talk on the forbidden secret, with the syllabus that goes with that. My talk on the planned police state and the syllabus that goes with that. If you don't believe that they're building concentration camps in America, well, you need to get our 4-tape set on concentration camps. You need to get the amazing clips, which, of course, you'll hear the Iran-Contra hearings, where Congressman Jack Brooks tried to bring out the truth about the concentration camps and the plan to suspend the Constitution and round up Americans and put them in concentration camps. You'll certainly want to get, of course, the DVD we carry, America Behind Barbed Wire. You need to know these things are not imaginary. I suggest the concentration camp special. That's the concentration camp special. And, of course, if you'd like one free catalog, our number 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like the health catalog or the dehydrated food catalog, give us a call. And then pray for America. And pray for Radio Liberty, please.
You You're listening to the Global Star Radio Network, located at Telstar 5 KU band, frequency 11836, symbol rate 20770. Thank you for listening.
IRN USA Radio News. I'm Greg Moore. President Bush believes the current situation in Iraq and Afghanistan is similar to post-war reconstruction after World War II. Bush made the comparison in a commencement address at the U.S. Air Force Academy.
After World War II, we helped Germany and Japan build free societies and strong